Welcome to the Indisposable Podcast, produced by Upstream. I'm your host, Brooking Gatewood.
And I'm your co-host, Matt Prindeville.
Thanks for joining for another episode celebrating solutions to plastic pollution. Happy Earth Day, Solutioneers! For the last 52 years, billions of people around the world have been celebrating our one wild and precious planet on this day and calling attention to some of the most pressing ways that human activities are threatening our many incredible and delicately balanced Earth systems. This year, the official Earth Day theme is Invest in Our Planet, so we thought this would be a great chance to talk about the connection between climate change, reuse, and how we might invest in an indisposable future for all by investing in a world without waste. Joining me for this conversation today are Marcel Howard, a policy analyst and coordinator with Upstream, whose focus is climate change and environmental justice, and Rich Grousset, a sustainability expert and social entrepreneur with Redish, whose focus is helping businesses to shift from single-use food service products to reusable alternatives. So with both of these guests today, we're going to get a little bit of the policy side and the business side of the question of how to link climate and reuse. So thank you guys so much for taking the time to speak with us today.
Thanks for having us, Brooking.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
So before we jump in, and as many of our regular listeners have probably noticed by now, I love to kick off our conversations with a little bit about your backgrounds that helps us understand the deeper why do you do what you do. So Marcel, maybe we can start with you. What got you interested in focusing your professional life on climate change and environmental justice?
Yeah, absolutely. I think for me, it really started with where I grew up. You know, I'm sort of originally from Newport News, Virginia, which is a minority-majority community in Southeast Virginia, right along the Chesapeake Bay. And we were home to the world's largest private shipyard, owned by Huntington Ingalls. And so I grew up being exposed to a variety of environmental injustices that really shaped and impacted our community on multiple levels. Now, having grown up in a very politically involved family, I easily developed a passion for the environment and politics, and later decided to pursue a degree focused in these areas, and eventually a career as well. My personal experiences of watching black clouds take over our downtown through the coal being prepared to be exported from the shipyard are what motivate me to this day, as I focus on ensuring future generations have a just and equitable world that is healthy and livable for all. And that's really what sort of drives me to this day with the work that I do every day.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that, Marcel. How about you, Rich?
Yeah, this is, I always struggle to tell the short version of the story, and I'll try to do my best for the listeners today. But, I grew up in a rural area outside of Syracuse, New York, and spent a lot of time outside in the woods as a kid. And I think that really formed a lot of my values growing up. But really, when I came to sustainability and waste specifically was when I decided to make sustainability my professional career and to align my career with my personal values. That's when I went to the University of Michigan's three-year program in business and sustainability and started to learn just how much we have been impacting our planet. And really, it was devastating. You know, I'd read some before, but going in depth in graduate school was shocking to learn about the climate trouble we were in, as well as all of the other ecosystems that were near tipping points due to human activity. And so I really, you know, was motivated to do something. And the part about waste and reuse was really the simple one, simply sitting in a restaurant with a colleague in grad school, eating out of a single-use product, a highly recyclable polypropylene material, with nowhere in sight to recycle it. It had to go in the trash. And it just led us to the conversation about there must be a better way. And it led us to start researching reusables, and we learned that they were already out there in the world. This was 2011, and since 2008 or so, a company had already been manufacturing reusable to-go containers, and they were being used at a bunch of universities. So that was my aha that there's already a solution. Maybe I can get involved in scaling it up and be a big part of reducing waste in the world. That's how I got started.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and as we often talk about on different episodes of this show, that reusable has been around for a very long time.
Right? Yeah, right. Like this is, yeah, it's a great point. You know, modern reuse history versus the rest of reuse history. You know, there's places like Mumbai that have been delivering a crazy amount of food in reusable products every day for a long time. So yeah, this is the modern reincarnation.
So Marcel, I'm thinking about what you shared in terms of, you know, growing up looking at these black clouds of smoke, you know, out the window in your neighborhood. And, you know, another thing we talk about a lot on the show is the often less understood than we would hope connection between oil and gas production and single-use disposable packaging, which I think is also part of the story of how reuse and climate are connected. So Marcel, will you help, you know, lay that connection out a little bit more for our listeners?
Absolutely, Brooklyn. So when it comes to climate and reuse, there's a lot of factors that are in play here. One, we have the global population having grown to over 7.7 billion people and continuing to increase. And this has really put a large strain on the environment, specifically through resource use, waste production, and environmental degradation, which are all accelerated by this continuous population growth. In addition to this, this degradation is further exacerbated by our consumption habits, which is really driven by the dominance of our current linear sort of take, make, and dispose consumption model. Now, this model is not sustainable. You know, it's really created a culture that embraces and rewards the production and consumption of single-use disposable products and packaging. Now, it's important to note that, you know, almost all of these products and packaging that are made from plastics all nearly start out as a fossil fuel in order to be fed into a feedstock or as a feedstock in order to produce the plastics. And now all throughout this entire plastic life cycle, these plastics also release greenhouse gases, whether it be from extraction to production, all the way to disposal and end of life. Now, in addition to emitting these greenhouse gases throughout the life cycle, these single-use products and packaging are littering our streets and oceans. I mean, we know that there are over 150 million metric tons of plastics in our oceans as of 2015, and we're expecting that to substantially grow over the next few decades as well. But it's also important to note that it's not just plastics, it's just single-use in general. Most single-use alternatives, like compostable products, have different but substantial environmental impacts, whether that be climate, water, land use, waste, or pollution impacts. So it's really about changing our overall consumption model and making sure that we're moving away from single use to reusable as a whole. And the one thing I'll sort of end this on is that when we take this consumption model, we look at it now where it's based off an extractive economy that is not rooted in justice and equity principles. So causing the issue of single use consumption to be bad for the environment, climate, and communities alike. So our current model is not helpful for anyone, and it's just making things worse for us.
Awesome. Rich, you have anything to add in terms of like the basics of the links that Marcel just covered so thoroughly? Thank you, Marcel.
Yeah, I was about to say that was a really excellent explanation. I don't know how much I have to add to it. I think it is just becoming more and more clear to more people, right? That this is a waste problem. You know, in the last few years specifically, we've seen an explosion in interest in plastic pollution. You know, the ubiquitous turtle with a straw in its nose, kind of 2017-ish time period. The amount of interest from the public and policymakers and everything has really grown, right? And that doesn't mean that we're at the critical mass we need to solve the problem. But I think this is the moment, right, when people are really starting to understand that it's not just waste, but climate and environmental justice and everything else.
Yeah. You know, one specific fact you mentioned, Marcel, that caught my attention that I haven't thought about that much is you said that there's greenhouse gas emissions in the disposal part of the process for, you know, landfilling and also just the disposal of all our waste. Can you say a little more about how that part of it works?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think when we're looking at disposables in general, they typically emit greenhouse gas emissions throughout the disposal process. And one of the main greenhouse gas emissions that you'll see when we're talking about any type of waste disposal in landfill, for example, is typically methane, which is much more potent than CO2, for example. And that can be really dangerous. And in addition to that, you have major issues or new innovations, if you will, in the disposal space, such as chemical recycling or incineration or waste to energy facilities. But the problem there is that not only are they emitting greenhouse gas emissions themselves, and majority of the time they're emitting more greenhouse gas emissions than if that product or packaging were to be in landfill, but a majority of these facilities are located in majority Black and brown, low-income, and indigenous communities. And so not only are they emitting additional greenhouse gas emissions by using these various types of mechanisms to gather energy or whatever it may be, but they're also severely impacting and disproportionately impacting these communities of color as well on the front lines. And so we're really seeing the impacts all over the place when we're talking about waste disposal. And again, whether that be chemical recycling, landfill, or incineration, they all have various negative environmental impacts.
Rich, you've been in this space a long time. Why do you think the link between climate and reuse is so slow to catch on in the general public?
This is a really tough question, and there's a number of variables there. I'm not an expert on consumer knowledge and behavior change, but I think there's a few things going on here, with regard to people understanding the link between single use and climate. First, we're up against the hill of people understanding that their behavior and human activity in general contributes to climate change. I just was looking at this Pew poll earlier today from 2020, and only 34% of millennials said that human activity contributes to climate change a great deal. And that was the best group. Of the baby boomers and older, it was only 14% of people saying that human activity contributed to climate change a great deal.
Oh, wow.
And so, that is a great level setter, because when you work in our space, like all of us do, it's hard to keep touch with people who don't study this day in and day out and think about it day in and day out like we do. And so it was a good reminder, like, oh, right, okay. Not everyone is making connections between human activity in general and their own activities in relation to climate change. And then the next part of that is that when they do think about it, we're seeing in the media, right, we see climate change, we often see coal, oil, solar, wind, electric cars, energy, all these things. We're not seeing maybe in the news and mainstream, at least I'm not. I'm probably not the best example because I don't watch a lot of mainstream media, but we don't see a lot of talk about, what is your shampoo bottle contributing to climate change, right? Or what happens to it after, right? We see these big topics of energy, and rightly so, they're huge. But what I don't think we're seeing in mainstream yet is the single use, the linear model, how that's contributing to climate change with consumer products and things like to-go containers and all those things. So I think we have a bit of ways to go before that comes in. When they see these products, they're thinking of trash and recycling, right? They see that's what they see in their neighborhood when they think about waste and single use, right? They see trash bin, recycling bin, maybe some places, if you're lucky, you see compost bin. And I don't think they immediately connect, at least not the mass market, right? We're talking everyday people. They're not making that connection to climate yet. That's where we have a lot of work to do.
Yeah. Yeah, that is good sort of ground setting for those of us who listen to the show a lot and may forget that not everybody pays as close attention. And tying it back to what Marcel was saying earlier too, there's the link between reuse and climate, and then the link between climate and social justice, which mm-hmm. my sense is people have more of an understanding of the link between climate and social justice than reuse and social justice outside of the Break Free from Plastic community, at least. What would you say, Marcel?
Yeah, I think in general, our society is in a sort of space where social justice is really at the forefront. And obviously a major issue and topic area that most individuals are talking about. But, I think there's still a little bit of a disconnect for some of those in the mainstream and mainstream society to acknowledge and understand that you know, redlining was a key reason why you have a majority of communities that are Black and Brown, low-income and Indigenous that are on the front lines of such facilities like incinerators and other petrochemical industry facilities as well, for example.
Yeah, and you just mentioned a term that some listeners may know and some may not, redlining. And, you know, my understanding, this is a practice that is at the root of a lot of the place and race-based discrimination in our country that affects political jurisdictions and also people's ability to get loans and things like this that ends up really affecting and changing the shape of neighborhoods and communities so that communities of color and lower income communities tend to end up near, you know, incinerators and near petrochemical plants. And the wealthier white communities tend to end up very far away from those environmentally and air quality destructive kinds of practices. And that's just one example of it. But that's the my basic understanding. Am I missing any key elements of it there, Marcel?
No, and I think you have it spot on there. And I think the one thing I'll just add is if you take a look at maps now of redlining maps or redlined neighborhoods, you know, back in the 60s, et cetera, and you look to where they are or a map of that same exact community now, what you'll notice is the obvious approachment or encroachment, rather, of these types of facilities and industrial polluters on these same communities that were redlined. So it's almost as if those same redline maps are still in use today, as instead of just focusing on a segregation of those communities, it's focused on where these facilities and the very polluting facilities are located in general.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we've kind of, so far in this conversation, we've laid out some, I see a triangle in my head about these key connections between climate change, social environmental justice, impacts of climate change, and reuse, or you could say the lack of reuse, and how when we're contributing to the single use problem, we're also contributing more to problems with environmental justice and climate. But when we get on board with the circular economy and reuse economy as a solution to a lot of things, it also addresses climate and environmental justice issues in addition to the more obvious waste issues that we so often talk about on this show. So we've kind of laid that foundation, and I want to pivot a little bit to talk with both of you about some of the interesting solutions that you all are working on in terms of making reuse available and making information available about this connection to people like our listeners so they can get involved with local government and all those good things. So let's start, Rich, with you and talk a little bit about the business side of things, because you've spent most of your career in that space. You're doing some really interesting work right now with ReDish. So tell us a little bit about the innovative model you guys are working on there. And also just more generally, like, what are you seeing the win-win for business and sustainability and climate goals in this business space that you're involved in?
Sure. So just for those that don't know, ReDish is a reusable foodware service. We provide food products like cups and to-go containers to organizations, primarily right now corporate cafeterias in New York City and K-12 schools, and it's a service. So it's similar to a linen or a uniform services. We deliver clean products. We collect the dirty products. We wash them in our own facility in Brooklyn, and we repeat. And the ReDish model was created by our CEO, Caroline Vanderlip, in recognition that there was a need for washing. You know, in New York City, for example, a huge majority of large cafeterias in large office buildings do not have industrial scale dishwashing capacity. So if they wanted to switch, you know, back to reusables from their single-use products now, they really wouldn't have the capacity to wash them. And so they would have to either buy expensive dishwashing infrastructure, maybe even create new space within their building, hire staff. And it's a lot easier just to use a service for that sort of thing. And that's the need that we met and have been meeting since, I guess, the company was founded coincidentally, a reuse company founded in the midst of the pandemic. Not great timing, but we had success nonetheless. And we started our first washing for a client in our facility in April of last year. And coincidentally, I was just looking at our numbers and for April, and this month we surpassed the total amount of products we've washed for clients that we did in 2021. And so this is great news for reuse. It's showing that the market for reuse is coming back strong, and that's good for all entrepreneurs. There's a lot of companies out there trying to do reuse and solve the problem in different ways. And so I think this is excellent news for our entire industry. But yeah, for Redish specifically, our primary goal is large food service operations, institutions. New York City is full of large office buildings, tons of K-12 schools, and we're open to other ones as well. But you know, with reuse, a key aspect of it is getting products back. And in every different situation, whether it's a zoo or a park or an event or a school, there are different situations with where people are going and how you get these things back. And so after solving having the washing, how to get them back is what most companies in the reuse space are trying to solve today. And we started with the corporate and the K-12 because we don't believe, and it's bearing out this way, that a lot of people leave with food containers anyway, right? So we capture a lot of them or nearly all of them without a whole lot of effort. Okay. Not to say it's easy, but it seems to be easier than other situations.
Yeah. So I want to step back and ask sort of the higher level question. So many businesses, especially the bigger businesses, these corporations that you might be serving, you know, in their dining halls, they have at this point huge sustainability plans that they follow, and they have climate targets. And I'm wondering how you are seeing reuse fitting into existing corporate sustainability planning and climate planning, and what's needed. What are the key next steps that we need to be working on to be able to have that integrate a little more easily?
You know, working with large corporate, you know, you can think of brand names that might have big office buildings in New York City. They are certainly, some of them have had climate goals and plastic reduction goals and all sorts of great efforts going on for years. And our original thought was, let's tap right into that, right? At first, it seemed more like it was the people closer to food service, you know, so your operations folks and your food service folks who are responsible for the waste coming from those things. It seemed like those folks were more motivated. And I think it's because they're closer to the customer experience and they're closer to the waste in operations. A lot of these companies, you know, you're talking about multinationals, their sustainability goals are a bit larger in scope than just what happens in one office building, right? And that's kind of the connection I'm trying to make. I'm not saying that all these other people in the company aren't as concerned. It's just that we're talking about one office building, and the sustainability people at one of these companies might have, you know, 40,000 people across the globe, and let alone the products their company might make, right? So we've been trying to connect the dots between their ESG goals and that motivation as well. And I think the one thing that is we're really working in the favor of reuse these days is the renewed interest in greenhouse gas emissions. You know, there's the SEC and other groups, you know, encouraging or requiring reporting in these areas now. And scope 3 is still optional, but some companies are getting out ahead of this. And a lot of suppliers of single-use products don't offer up climate metrics on their product, right? They don't offer up a life cycle greenhouse gas emissions footprint for, you know, X plastic clamshell. Whereas we as a reuse company are able to provide that information. And we've seen clients being very interested in that aspect of our business. The fact that we can provide climate metrics directly to them on the service they're getting, right?
Because then they can make it part of what they are counting.
Exactly, right? Yeah. I mean, everyone knows scope 3 report. Well, everyone doesn't know this, but scope 3 reporting is extremely complicated because it includes basically everything your company buys from someone else, right? And there could be thousands of suppliers included in that group. And to get them all to provide you greenhouse gas emissions data is challenging. So to have suppliers just offering up that information and not requiring you to do any work as a corporate makes their life very easy. So I think that's a huge benefit of reuse. But in addition to the fact that we align with all of their stated goals on waste reduction, right? If they have zero waste goals, even better. Right. And those are the more obvious ones, you know. And the other one is that this is a highly visible sustainability element in their operations that their employees will touch and feel every day. Not many of their sustainability initiatives, you know, company-wide have that benefit of tangibility, right? It's in their hands, they're seeing it, and they can tell that story and really make that connections. You know, if they just have a climate goal and they're doing great, that's awesome, but employees don't see greenhouse gas reductions from their company in front of their face. So I think that tangible thing is also an important element.
That's a really key point, because I do feel like, you know, in this conversation about how reuse can contribute to the climate movement, that's such a key point, you know, both for business and policy. And on that note, Marcel, tell us a little bit about what kinds of actions local governments can take to support programs like ReDish and the many other awesome efforts that we have featured on the show and that Upstream is involved in supporting.
You know, I think there's really two things that we'll focus in on here. And it's, you know, the first thing is what local governments can do regarding reuse solutions in general. And then, you know, how can local governments sort of make that connection between reuse and climate as well? And, you know, I think first, local governments really need to shift their focus from waste management to waste prevention. You know, reduce and reuse come before recycling in a waste hierarchy. And they really deserve and must have their own standalone policies in order to have any real impacts. You know, local governments can also develop pilot programs in their communities to understand the full benefits of reuse and how to scale up a reuse system, for example. And they should also, you know, work to develop grant and funding opportunities for businesses looking to become next-gen innovators like Rich over at ReDish and creating new reuse systems in general. And, you know, I think in addition to that, they must also engage directly with diverse constituents to understand and really embed equity and justice concepts within these policies that are critical in changing our current economic model. And, you know, secondly, you know, regarding climate, you know, local governments must really begin developing consumption-based emissions inventories, which are a way to really capture those scope 3 emissions that Rich was just mentioning. And that's really those embedded emissions that are associated with imported products and packaging. And they need to update their climate action plans from a local government standpoint in order to address those new emissions that will be found when they create those consumption-based emissions inventories. And keep reuse solutions in mind here when they're updating those climate action plans. And lastly, you know, I think one key component here with those climate action plans is for local governments to develop and implement specific reuse targets and have reuse solutions as a climate mitigation strategy. And I think, you know, if local governments can really do that, then reuse has a chance to really scale and have a huge impact on our climate emissions.
I love it. That sounds really inspiring. I know that you and the team at Upstream have been working really hard on creating a toolkit that I believe is coming out the same day this podcast is coming out. So listeners, we're going to start talking about it. And of course, check it out. Episode notes will have the link to it that shares resources about this connection between climate and reuse. So Marcel, tell us a little bit about what's in the toolkit and how it might help our listeners be able to take action, share information, and more.
So, you know, we have officially launched this climate toolkit. We've been working diligently over the past few months on this as well. And really, this toolkit is designed to inform advocates and policymakers alike about how reuse should be viewed as a critical mechanism for solving the world's plastics and climate problems, and ultimately how plastic and climate relate in the first place. You know, this toolkit includes a variety of resources, including a climate reuse-focused briefing document. We have a few fact sheets around reuse and climate and even reuse and water usage. We have a train the trainer presentation for advocates and policymakers to give on the connection between reuse and climate. We even have an example letter of support for reuse as a climate mitigation strategy for legislators, as well as a research document with all of Upstream's key resources on making the connection between reuse and climate. And finally, we have various downloadable assets for advocates and policymakers to use when making this argument of reuse as a climate solution in general. So one, we're trying to provide resources for policymakers and advocates alike, but two, we're really trying to sort of start this call to action for looking at reuse solutions as a climate mitigation strategy. And in order to really adapt our climate action plans and our overall strategies to reduce emissions, we see reuse as that solution. And so this climate toolkit will provide the resources to those individuals, to those key stakeholders, to help make that argument moving forward.
Yeah, if I could just add to that, Marcel, I love this toolkit. And boy, do I wish Upstream was doing this for every single problem that was out there in the world, because I think it would really solve a lot of problems. But it's fortunate for companies like Redish that you're doing it in this space, because I do believe it's really going to help organizations like ourselves. You know, we're approaching reuse as a business problem, right? And we believe we can solve the problem and make a profit and be attractive to investors. And, you know, it would be a win-win from that standpoint. But what's interesting is that, you know, reuse to compete with single use economically really needs the scale. And, you know, getting to scale really involves the infrastructure, right? We built a large dishwashing facility, and actually today our many times bigger dish machine arrived from overseas, and we're excited to set that up, and that's going to give us even more scale efficiency. But, you know, when we're looking at municipal scale reuse programs, I think what we're going to start looking at is infrastructure such as street corner collection bins, or, you know, some sort of coordinated citywide infrastructure. And that is expensive, right? Mm-hmm. And so we're going to need folks who are investing in the climate space, as well as the municipalities, to all understand what this means from a climate perspective, right? And so they can add it to their climate priorities. Because without the CBEI, people really aren't going to understand what the emissions are created and caused by the behavior of people in cities, you know? And so getting that all out on the table is really going to help move the needle.
Yeah, Rich, you really answered the question that I was going to ask you in terms of why this toolkit is exciting for businesses and how it can be useful to you all. So I'm really happy to hear you say that. And it strikes me that part of what Upstream is doing and others in the National Reuse Network and Break Free from Plastic community is starting to build this connection between reuse and climate and other environmental sustainability goals, so that when larger institutions and governments are considering climate and sustainability related plans, then there would be an opportunity for a company like Redish or other vendors who are ready to provide these solutions at a larger scale to fit into those planning processes, right? And so it seems like that's the direction we're looking to go here with what you guys are doing in the policy space. Is that a fair assessment, Marcel?
Yes, absolutely. And I think, you know, I think what we're looking at when it comes to the NRN, for example, is really trying to start filling some of the data gaps that exist. You know, making this connection is going to be difficult without being able to capture the true data, the true emissions data, rather, that's associated with these products and packaging that we're creating and consuming. And so I think, you know, that's really the next big step for us as we continue to advocate and push for this moving forward.
Yeah. And if people want to get involved in helping fill that data gap, what's the best way for them to do that?
For starters, I'd say absolutely reach out to Upstream and look to join the National Reuse Network. I mean, we're actually covering climate in our April meeting, so it's definitely front of mind and something that we're focusing on as well. In addition to joining the NRN, you know, I think there's also other opportunities such as you know, Upstream's sort of putting on or hosting a climate working group. We're working to solve some of these issues and to fill some of these data gaps on the connection between climate and reuse. And that's just another avenue where we're working collaboratively within our networks and trying not to reinvent the wheel when it comes to resources in order to figure out, you know, how reuse can really be used as a climate mitigation strategy moving forward. And so absolutely reach out to myself or anyone on the policy team or anyone here at Upstream, and we can have those conversations moving forward.
Fantastic. This is really exciting resource and great work. Again, listeners, we'll put the link in the show notes. It includes Train the Trainer, great presentation with lots of good facts, fact sheets. I believe there's a letter to representatives to if you want to get involved politically and write your local representatives to get them to think about reuse as a climate mitigation strategy and put it in the formal policy work and documentation. And also Rich's website, ReDish, if you're interested in that model, will be in the show notes as well. And I know, Marcel, that there's something interesting on the horizon that Upstream's working on with regard to environmental justice. So do you want to give us a little teaser on that before we close?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, we've developed this climate toolkit here on to focus on the connection between climate and reuse, but we're also in the midst of finalizing our environmental justice toolkit. And in this toolkit, it will be very similar resources of the climate toolkit. But here, we're really just going to dive a little bit deeper into the connection between environmental justice and reuse solutions and how reuse solutions offer a pathway towards a just transition. So definitely keep an eye out for that coming in about mid-June from Upstream. And we're excited to be discussing that and releasing that soon.
Awesome. So thank you both so much for joining me today and for all the beautiful work you're doing in the world.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed it. And I could talk for hours and hours with you both, but appreciate the opportunity to talk for this a little bit.
Sentiment is same on my side, and very much appreciate the time.
And that's our show. If you like what you're hearing, help spread the word. Subscribe to the Indisposable podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Add a review, talk us up. Nobody spreads a message like you. The Indisposable podcast is brought to you by Upstream, sparking innovative solutions to plastic pollution, envisioning a world without it, and empowering businesses, communities, and individuals to imagine and co-create this future with us. You can find resources mentioned on today's episode, as well as learn more about Upstream's work at www.upstreamsolutions.org. Follow us on social and join the movement. There's a better way than throwaway.